is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
My town is burning, never returning. Nowhere to go, no home. Old church, old school, old trees. In photographs, in my mind, my mind.
Los Angeles burned in January? Not what I was expecting. But it is another burned downtown with more to come. Late American author Mike Davis told us this would happen. Meanwhile, the mystery of a hot 2023 and 24 is solved. NASA scientist George Saloniotis warns shrinking cloud cover is happening as the planet warms. Plus, the rate of CO2 change can weaken the Gulf Stream, the AMOC, that keeps the UK and Scandinavia warm. Important new science from Dr. Camille Henkel. Fire, clouds, and currents this week on Radio EcoShock. Welcome. Probably you already heard too much about big fires in Los Angeles in week one of 2025. Strong Santa Ana winds are well known, but flash droughts and water whiplash are not. Southern California got lots of rainfall and snowpack in the mountains from late 2022 until about spring this year. Then the tap turned off. The chaparral plants on the hills and valleys had thrived, and they dried up to tinder by this fall. The back-and-forth change from rainfall and instability in hydrology is covered in a new paper by Dr. Daniel Swain. I would call for an interview with him, but no chance of that until later this month. Swain runs the very popular WeatherWest blog. His virtual office hours for the public on YouTube during these fires were the best, much better than any of the networks. Swain took us to Watch Duty, a fabulous source, then to weather maps, and then right to trail cams to check for fire. He knew it all. It was masterful. Swain just started a new job at the University of California, Agriculture and Natural Resources, as a climate scientist in the California Institute for Water Resources. And he looked a little pale on YouTube. He was working through a respiratory infection, and he was still the best. I hope to catch him later when the fires and the illness are all over. Find lots of links to Daniel Swain in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Before we get to our scientist guests, I just want to point to two Radio EcoShock sources regarding these fires. Last November, I interviewed Associate Professor Jennifer Balk about the fastest growing and most destructive fires in the U.S. 2001 to 2020. She wanted us all to know the importance of a fire is not based on its final size, but how fast it grows in the beginning. That is what determines the damage on human scales, and we sure saw a prime example of fast fires roaring through Los Angeles. Check out that 18-minute interview with Jennifer if you missed it, with links in my blog. In 1990, California author, scholar, and social critic Mike Davis explained why California would burn. He's the author of well-known works like The Ecology of Fear and Planet of the Slums. Mike was distinguished professor in creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, and an editor of the New Left Review. After massive California fires in 2018, I called him up. He thought about fires in Los Angeles and San Diego and then zeroed in on Malibu as a prime target. And here we are, with Malibu burned. Let's take a quick listen to Mike Davis on the Malibu fires compared to the Paradise Fire that destroyed 15,000 structures and killed almost 100 people. The news, it turns out, is different for the rich and the poor.
Radio EcoShock.
When California burned in 2018, I thought of Mike Davis. In the early 1990s, Davis wrote books explaining why all this was inevitable. Davis grew up in Southern California, where he became a powerful leftist voice and a celebrated author. From The Ecology of Fear to Planet of Slums, everyone has felt ripples from his work. Mike Davis is a distinguished professor in creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, and an editor of the New Left Review. Mike Davis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be on.
In your 1992 book, The Ecology of Fear, you wrote a lot about human incursion into fire areas and the inevitable blowback of wildfires into suburbs and monster homes in Malibu. How does that feel after the terrible fires hit both Southern and Northern California in late 2018?
I often write about things that personally terrify me. And I've seen Los Angeles burn and San Diego, where I now live, burn too many times not to be frightened by the phenomena. So I take no pleasure or vindication in what's happened. But these fires, and in a terrible but persistent way, underline the inequalities that govern California today, and the inequalities in terms of housing, of income, and of access to the wild areas of the state. And I recently wrote something called A Tale of Two Fires, contrasting the Paradise Fire, which destroyed 15,000 structures and killed almost 100 people, with the Malibu Fire, which destroyed 1,500 structures and killed 3 or 4 people.
Yes, I know that in Paradise, California, I was talking to some folks there, and they said that it was mainly a low-income community, and few had fire insurance. And now, incidentally, Donald Trump wants to cut off FEMA aid to California fire victims. My question, are the poor set up for a big fall as climate-driven disasters roll through these unsustainable lifestyles?
Well, on a global scale, I think we can speak of a kind of tirage and advance that's occurred, that basically contemporary debates on climate change, the huge resistance not only to reducing carbon footprints, but to providing the kind of hundreds of billions of dollars of aid that are necessary to adapt the most vulnerable and exposed communities to inevitable rising sea levels and droughts and to the loss of agricultural land. Absolutely. It's first and above all a question of the Earth's poor. In California, with the wildfires, which undoubtedly have a component of anthropogenic climate change in their causality, you see two forms of inequality. In Paradise, the case of people who were unable to find housing, priced out of the housing market, even in the Central Valley. The coast has become so unaffordable. The Californians have moved into the Central Valley and other inland areas in the search of affordable housing. Many of the people in Paradise can afford even to live in the valley floor. So Paradise became a kind of attractive refuge for people on fixed incomes, for people with large families, and so on. But like Malibu, it shares the distinction of being a fire corridor, which time and time again has experienced catastrophic fires. In this case, community of 25,000 people built on a ridge overlooking the gorge of the Feather River, and backed by a notorious wind gap in the Sierras, where annually winds will come at 40, 50, even 70, 80 miles an hour. In Malibu, a similar situation in that Malibu is part of a western Santa Monica Mountain topography. The canyon's perfectly aligned to the direction of the seasonal Santa Ana winds. And in Malibu, you've had areas that have been burnt 5-6 times in the last century. Basically, Malibu burns whenever the brush, the coastal sage and chaparral, is mature enough to burn, which is why I raised the question of why should society subsidize wealthy homeowners in Malibu who have almost unlimited guarantee of fire prevention and firefighting resources in a landscape that simply wants to burn and will burn. There have been 7 or 8 major Malibu fires in my lifetime. But you can contrast the two situations. In Paradise, people with low incomes are unable to really live anywhere else. And in Malibu, people with extraordinary high incomes, but most of all with formidable political clout, able to afford to rebuild time and time again, and with the guarantee that government will put all the firefighting resources it can on the line to defend their homes. A very different situation from Paradise, where all of this was circumscribed by a county budget deficit and fiscal crisis, which, for instance, prevented the widening or the building of other escape routes from this community, which had grown so rapidly in the last 20 years.
So if we want to educate ourselves about your work, should we begin with something like City of Quartz, Excavating the Future of Los Angeles? And what is the relationship between that book and the Ecology of Fear book 2 years later?
Well, one of the principal themes of City of Quartz are the consequences of unregulated speculative real estate markets on the form, the quality of life, and the democracy of Los Angeles. I engaged these issues principally in a chapter on power in Los Angeles, another chapter on the biggest social movement in Los Angeles during the 1980s and early 1990s, which were homeowners associations attempting to control growth in their communities and to protect or expand their home equity. And Ecology of Fear, the subsequent book, kind of second installment in my LA writing, I face the issue directly and show that in virtually every generation, Southern California has had prophets and visionaries who truly saw the problems that existed at the nexus between urbanization and Southern California's wild environment, and who advocated a different model of urbanization based on greater equality of housing, but also on controlled growth that would preserve agricultural areas and ban development in the mountains. And the fire chapter talks on one hand about Malibu and their almost limitless entitlements, and on the other hand, by fire syndrome that seems now finally to have been eliminated in the city. But Los Angeles has a terrible history of tenement fires, often producing death tolls in double figures. And again, as in the case of Paradise, the fire protection available was dictated solely by city budgets and investment in fire services without the kind of federal and state entitlements that wealthy communities on the coast possess. So it's been a kind of persistent theme. I've also dwelt at great length, and in fact this explains the title of Ecology of Fear, on the systematic confusion between the social and the natural in Southern California. And I wrote it at a time when people were referring to mountain lions in the hills, comparing them to gang members, and talking about wilding gangs and predatory youth as if they were dangerous animals in the city. And so much of the confusion in the identity and practices of Southern California are rooted in basic misunderstandings of the nature of environmental processes and our particular, you know, Mediterranean climate, where environmental change doesn't come seasonally in small amounts in the kind of uniformitarian way that's characteristic of, say, New England or Great Britain, but occurs in occasional bursts, which all the kind of energy of climate and erosion and, you know, an earthquake concentrated into moments which strike people as being catastrophes, when in fact they're simply the normal metabolism, well familiar to anyone else who lives in a Mediterranean environment in Southern Europe, Cape area in South Africa, Western Australia, Chile, and so on.
That was the late Mike Davis on Radio EcoShock in January 2019. Is still essential reading to rethink the new war on authority against the masses or wealth against justice happening right now. Listen to or download the whole interview, free of course, from my blog at ecoshock.org. It's published Wednesdays in Pacific Time. Let us now escape into the clouds. Satellites show more energy is staying on Earth instead of bouncing back into space. The sun did not change. So why were the last 2 years significantly hotter than any recorded before? For scientists, it became a race to find the cause. Now we have a confident answer based not on theories or models, but on raw observations. Blame the clouds. George Seliotis is a research physical scientist at NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He came through physics to meteorology and entered the early days of climate science. Well, recently he crunched 40 years of satellite records with his team, and they were analyzing the cloud cover on Earth. They found the world's storm zones are contracting. The land and sea may be getting less shade, leading to record heating. This is breaking knowledge we need. From New York, George Seliotis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Does your research suggest changes in cloud cover warm the Earth more than human-made gases?
It's hard to say that it's more than greenhouse gases. Clouds are a feedback to the warming, meaning that greenhouse gases are a forcing. In other words, we emit more greenhouse gases and we force the atmosphere. Now, once the atmosphere is forced, it responds. And one of the responses is by making more or less clouds, or making more clouds of one kind and fewer clouds of another kind. So clouds are a response to the forcing. That's why we call them feedbacks. Now, how big or how strong is this cloud feedback is something that we haven't really confidently resolved yet. It may be that the feedback, the cloud feedback in itself, can be even bigger than the forcing at some points, but I cannot say at this point that we're confident that we know the value of the cloud feedback to the extent that we can judge whether it's larger or smaller than the forcing. Overall, it appears to be smaller than the forcing because clouds warm and cool the climate at the same time. They reflect sunlight and they cool the climate, but they also trap heat and they warm the climate. So when we add all the cloud effects together, it turns out that the feedback is relatively small, or at least our best estimate for the feedback. Again, we're not confident about this feedback number yet, so I cannot really give a definitive answer to that question.
Fair enough. Well, you obviously know former NASA scientist James Hansen. His team pointed to sulfur reductions in ship emissions as a probable cause of the recent spike in warming and the Earth energy imbalance. They found fewer clouds over shipping lanes in the Pacific. Is that enough to explain the extra energy? Are these the cloud changes that you covered in your two recent papers?
Well, the changes in shipping emissions is definitely one of the reasons for the recent increases in the amount of absorbed solar radiation at the Earth's surface. However, the changes in shipping emission regulations were imposed basically from 2020 on, so the effects are over the last 4 or 5 years, the effects that we're seeing from those new regulations. I mean, there were some regulations starting in 2015, but we believe that the main regulations really that had a real effect are the ones that started in 2020. The changes that I am showing in the last two papers, basically the last 40 years, so this reduction in the world's storm cloud zones is something that we observe in satellite observations over the last 40 years. So whatever is happening with the shipping emissions is in addition to this background of changes that is in response to the reduction of this storm cloud zone. So the two are not the same thing. One is a smaller probably smaller effect, but much longer term, much more longer term. The other is a much more recent effect and may well be more intense overall.
You know, clouds and cloud study are super complex. There were several times when I just had to sort of walk away from your paper and then come back to it because it requires a lot of learning just to get there. But why don't we break it down a little bit? We could start with the zones of the atmosphere where your group found significant cloud change. Closest to the equator, what is this intertropical convergence zone in the atmosphere? What goes on there?
The intertropical convergence zone is a zone that basically circles the globe near the equator. It's a zone of very thick rainy clouds. It's a very wet with thick raining clouds. It's called a convergence zone because at the surface there's a convergence of the surface winds that favors the lifting of the moisture from the surface and therefore favors the formation of the very thick storm clouds in that region. So the intertropical convergence zone is this zone where the atmosphere is converging at the surface, is lifting up the moisture, and is producing very thick, very reflective, and very hard-raining clouds.
And you found some changes in the clouds in this intertropical convergence zone, or we could call it ITCZ. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, what we find when we look at the satellite observations is a narrowing of this intertropical convergence zone. Basically, this zone is becoming more narrow. Now, we're not the first ones to find this narrowing of the ITCZ. There have been studies in the past, in the last 10 years, that have looked at precipitation rather than clouds, because you can also see this intertropical convergence zone in precipitation observations, since that's a very hard-raining region. And they also found this narrowing of the intertropical convergence zone. Also, there have been modeling studies that find a similar narrowing of that zone with climate warming. So we have a reason to suspect that the narrowing of the zone is in response to climate warming.
All right, let's move to the zone closer to many of our listeners called the mid-latitude storm zones in your study. For example, what countries are we talking about, and are some of those places experiencing changed storm tracks even now?
Well, there are three basic storm track regions, mid-latitude storm track regions. There's the North Atlantic storm track region, there's the North Pacific storm track region, and then there's the Southern Ocean one. Now, those storm track regions are better defined and more easy to observe from satellites over oceans. At the same time, however, the Pacific storm track region is the one that really enters the U.S. from the West Coast and is the one that affects the parts of the weather in the western part of the region. Now, once it crosses the mountains, there is the mountain barrier effect, but then the storms reform again near the eastern coast, and then they form the North Atlantic storm track, which starts from northeast U.S. and crosses the Atlantic and then enters northern Europe and the British Isles, and it's the storms that are affecting Europe are basically coming from this branch of the storm tracks. So both the U.S., Europe, and Asia are affected, northern Asia are affected by these storm tracks, the North Pacific and the North Atlantic storm tracks. The Southern Ocean storm track is really a more regular one because there aren't as many land areas, so it circumnavigates the globe, mostly over ocean, somewhere in between the Antarctic and the tips of Africa and South America, but it's mostly an oceanic storm zone. It's affecting Australia and New Zealand and the southern parts of South America, but it's mostly an oceanic storm track.
And you found some cloud changes are cooling the world at the same time, and so that brings up the key question, how does the reduced cloud heating and increased cloud cooling, how does that all balance out?
What we find when we do an analysis of the cloud changes over the past 40 years in the satellite observations is that at lower latitudes, say between 40 south and 40 north, basically we have a reduction in the cloud cover, which of course means more sunlight coming in, less reflection of the clouds, so more warming. However, if you move to higher latitudes, poleward of 40 or 50 degrees, in both hemispheres, generally, in most data sets, we find an increase in cloud cover. Some data sets show no change, basically a near zero change. Some others show an increase in cloud cover, which would imply basically an opposite effect. More clouds is more reflection, and in some sense, it's a cooling effect.
So if regional changes in cloud cover can create very different effects, some places heating, some places cooling, does that amplify differences in the climate and, I guess, the weather down below experienced in different parts of the world?
Yes, that's definitely the case. And the other thing that it does is it either increases or decreases the differences between the climate of different regions. And atmospheric circulation is basically driven by differences in temperature, not by the temperature itself. So when we have cold air in one place and warm air in another, that's when atmospheric circulation cells are forming, wanting to move the cold air towards the hot air region. So changes like that, differences in changes between regions, doesn't just change the climate of the regions themselves in a different way, it also changes the flow of the atmosphere between those regions.
And we should be clear, your latest report is based on observations, pretty reliable since the year 2000, from satellites, and this is not a theory, but the paper stops at 2023 without predicting future developments in clouds, and for that we might need to run a big climate model that includes cloud feedbacks and Earth energy balance. Has that modeling been done, George?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's several models that have been run. These are all the models that we use to predict future climate. So what we're in the process of doing right now is testing to see how well the models are simulating the current climate changes. And then we're going to, once we know the level of confidence that we have in the models, we're going to see how those changes evolve in the future and, of course, put more credence in the better behaving models or the more skillful models in order to get some conclusions on how these cloud changes will evolve in the future.
Wow. I mean, think back to ancient Greece, and now here we are talking about possibly knowing the future of clouds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Aristotle would be very happy.
Yeah. So we've been talking about changes in cloud cover that increase warming, but does that warming also change cloud cover? I mean, is this a feedback relationship we're discussing?
Yes, yes, by all means. That's what makes it complicated, because the two are feeding on each other. Clouds are affecting the radiation, which affects the warming, and then this warming affects evaporation, water transports, vertical and horizontal water transports, which are forming the clouds. And it's all a fairly complicated feedback loop, and this is what makes it hard to understand and hard to quantify.
In 2019, NASA's Tapio Schneider suggested there was a tipping point in cloud formation, especially the tropical stratocumulus decks of low cloud that helped cool the tropics. The amount of CO2 for that tipping point was unknown, but much higher than today, maybe above 1,200 parts per million CO2. But what if we are not dealing with a tipping point per se, but a progression, which your new paper is bringing to light?
Yeah, I believe the use of the term tipping point is a little, we use it a lot in science to describe something that takes us into a different equilibrium state. However, we always reach tipping points in a progression, in a slow movement. I believe that the paper you're referring to was using a model, was doing what we said before, increasing the concentration of CO2 and then observing the changes in the marine stratocumulus clouds. And then, you know, the tipping does not happen in a year. I mean, the marine stratocumulus decks decrease slowly until they reach a point where they're pretty much very